Hello and welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast series brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm your host, Nitya Subramanian, an editor at the Institute. The Finance Minister of India, Mrs. Nirmala Sitharaman, recently unveiled the budget for financial year 2021-22, which has overall been well received for its pro-growth strategies. Among other things, it also laid out an ambitious divestment target to raise capital. While there are many challenges before the government, the success of this divestment strategy is crucial to revving up growth. To give us more insights, we have with us Dr. Amitendu Palit, our Senior Research Fellow and Research Lead, Trade and Economics. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Nitya. A pleasure to be with you here today.
Let me start off by asking you the most discussed proposal in the budget this year. One of the big announcements was, of course, this divestment plan. The finance ministry has pegged the target at rupees 1.7 trillion or about Singapore dollar 32 billion. Though this is slightly lower than last year, what are the factors that prompted the government to set such an ambitious target this time around, especially when the economies around the world are grappling with the COVID-19 pandemic?
I think there are two ways of looking at the entire question of disinvestment and privatization. The first is, it's not that privatization was not figuring on the government's agenda even earlier. Privatization, in fact, has been an important element of the budget-making exercise on a regular basis, not just with the current government, but even with the previous governments. But I think the difference that is beginning to show up is the fact that, to a very large extent, privatization is a term which is not used as candidly or as emphatically as the current budget has done. And normally the practice in the Indian policymaking parlance has been to show a greater preference for the term disinvestment as opposed to the word privatization. And that is understandable because privatization tends to evoke a large amount of negative responses from various stakeholders. And number two, disinvestment was much more appropriate with the way privatization was being handled by the government of India, because it essentially implied offloading government equity in the government enterprises with the objective of earning some much-needed revenue. And this revenue is important because it is a non-debt creating source of revenue. The second point, apart from the revenue point, which I think is important to be noted in the current context, is that today, at least in the budget that we are getting to see being debated and will be passed in the parliament pretty soon, is a budget which is being presented under very unusual circumstances. And that is not just because of the COVID-19, but also the concomitant effect of the fact that India has been experiencing a remarkable contraction in GDP. Now, this has a large number of implications. And one of the implications is, and this is something which I would like to build up in the context of the earlier revenue point that I mentioned. One of the prospects staring hard at the government as it goes ahead into the current year is the big gap that it is experiencing, or likely to experience even more starkly, between projected expenditure and projected revenue receipts. This is a year where the government really could not hold back expenditure. Expenditure had to be given the big push, and each big push at all rounds had to be bigger than the earlier rounds. This entailed a major access to revenues which otherwise would have been spent in more specific areas of development, of economic institution building, of economic recharging, if one can define it that way. But what has happened is that the government has been forced to spend well beyond what it visualized it would. And the COVID-19 and the negative GDP growth is a situation where it is very difficult for the government to also visualize any action towards raising taxes and stimulating revenues through higher taxes. So coming to this difficult challenge that on one hand, the expenditures for the government are rising at a rapid pace. On the other hand, the conventional routes of mobilizing revenue are limited. So the government was not really left with much option other than going for an all-out aggressive strategy of selling off government equity. And I think the point to be noted over here is that it is not just a question of privatization or disinvestment. It is also this other emphasis which has come in the budget on the fact that a large number of idle assets of the government are going to be monetized and that money is going to be put into use as far as development and social sector is concerned. So I think I would define the current budget and the privatization policy that has been announced in the current budget as not unprecedented, but certainly very different in terms of the emphasis that it puts on privatization, along with the outlining of a very clear strategy for privatization.
That's very interesting, because this is not, as you rightly said, this is also not the first time the government has put out such an ambitious target. In fact, last year's target was much higher than what was announced this time round. But the track record of divestment in India has been quite poor. The government has always been grappling to meet with the numbers. So what do you think it will do this time around to ensure that it at least comes close to its target, if not achieve it fully?
I think you are absolutely right when you mention about the numbers, the estimated numbers that the budget has been proposing each year when it comes to capital receipts and government receipts, and the realization with respect to those numbers. In fact, these are actually quite disappointing if the government can sort of kind of look at it that way. Today, this current budget is looking at 1.75 trillion Indian rupees as the possible route for mobilization of receipts through disinvestment. But if one looks at the earlier figure, I think the earlier figure for the earlier year was even higher in this regard. So what that essentially means is that for the government, it has not been an easy journey as far as moving on disinvestment is concerned. And we know of why that has not been so, because disinvestment is a very complicated process. Disinvestment is not just a question of identifying government enterprises and selling their assets in the open market. Disinvestment needs to be structured through a particular process, which involves very careful valuation of their assets. And let's not forget that there are not many public sector undertakings whose current assets at current market value are really worth a lot. There would probably be a handful among the current central public sector undertakings, or the CPESEs, whose current assets at the current market value would really fetch a good sum of money. But most of the public sector undertakings, including public sector banks that the government is holding on to, actually would yield asset values that are not particularly appetizing from a revenue mobilization perspective. But nonetheless, when these are brought to the market and taken to the investors for potential offering, they need to go through a particular process of structuring, valuation, and then eventually being presented through the capital markets to the investors in a formal structured fashion, which clearly involves a fair bit of work. And that work, which is primarily executive in nature, has to be combined with the fact that in this entire process, there are conflicts of interest that arise. The first conflict of interest arises from a certain group of stakeholders who clearly have been instrumental in the running of central public sector undertakings, and those have been the source of their authority or ability to influence decisions or lobbying in whatever ways one experiences this. These could be the labor unions, this could be the staff, this could be the CPSE managements. In certain cases, there are also parts of the government ministries and departments who really have considerable vested interest in trying to ensure that the disinvestment process doesn't actually materialize. It's a negative and a cynical way of looking at disinvestment, but there are internal resistances which come to disinvestment. Now, obviously, these are the reasons. And finally, one needs to also look at the fact that the market conditions, like particularly last year, the market conditions weren't very conducive for taking a new offer of disinvestment to investors because the investor appetite itself was pretty low. So if one combines all these factors together, then perhaps it is not very difficult to explain why disinvestment has not really materialized according to the targets that the government has set. But having said that, the question that arises is that in the current year, is the government making another ambitious assumption again by fixing the 1.75 trillion target or more than $30 billion target that it has? Well, I think the answer to that lies in the ability of the government to sell off at least a couple of central public sector undertakings, which could be considered the high-value undertakings. If the high-value undertakings are sold off, even one or two, then the government would actually be in a position to claim that we have been able to mobilize almost two-thirds or even more of the target that we had set. And that itself will be a substantial achievement. So if one looks at organizations like BPCL or the Air India, or if one more closely looks at some of the banks that the government is looking to identify for privatizing, I think these are really the big ticket investments which would contribute a long way towards the fulfillment of the budgeted target of disinvestment. And I think the final point which makes me a little bit more optimistic about the realization of disinvestment targets this year is the fact that this is probably the first time where the government has really shown the intention to use the word privatization very emphatically and make it very clear that the government really wants to walk back from the space that it has occupied in the Indian economy's production segment. And they want to do it not in a piecemeal fashion, but in a way that the effective ownership of the assets that it has been holding for so long actually gets to be held by the private sector. Because earlier, if you recall, whenever there was sale of government equity, the sale of government equity didn't necessarily result in a strategic shift of ownership as far as the public to private transition was concerned. It was just a question, in most cases, of government equity coming down by a certain percentage, but the majority ownership in most cases would still continue to be with the government. I think this time the intention very clearly is that it is not just a question of diluting government equity. It is more comprehensively a question of transferring the ownership. So the government doesn't remain the owner of the assets it holds anymore. It's very willing and keen to make the private sector the owner of those assets. So that, I think, is also a positive signal.
Thank you, Amitendu. You've covered many small points, which I'll slowly perhaps ask you to elaborate a little more upon. You very rightly said that the government this time has clearly put forward its intention of exiting most of the sectors, except for four strategic ones, where it says it will hold a minimum public sector presence. And also the array of companies that they have announced, as you rightly said, BPCL, LIC, some of the banks may be good candidates, while we have these extremely loss-making companies like Air India, which it has been finding very hard to get interest. The government has been finding it very hard to get interest from a private sector. So what are your thoughts? How do you think, is it going to be that, you know, is it going to be like a carrot and stick? I mean, it's not perhaps the right analogy, but would it just throw in some good companies as the carrot and then hope that the others would also be taken up?
Well, I think that you actually point to a major dilemma that has always existed in the entire approach and strategy towards privatization of government enterprises in India. Well, from one managerial or even government ownership perspective, the intention always probably was that, look, let's do away with the bad ones and let's try to retain the better ones as far as the government is concerned. So it's not just a question of government being identified with companies which are doing well, but also government benefiting from a certain degree of profits and surpluses which these companies earn and putting them into strategic use. Because, say, for example, when one looks at sectors like oil, energy, telecom, these are primarily strategic sectors in whichever way, economically, politically, or in any other health or strategic security perspective that one can look at. These are strategic sectors and the government picking on retaining some presence in the sectors. But the problem is outside of these sectors, wherever the government enterprises are functioning, whether they be central government or the state government, they're not really doing very well. And that, in fact, is a point that has been noted for a long time. So when those not doing very well enterprises are being put up for sale, the intention is probably relatively more conservative on part of the government, but unfortunately that conservative response is not fetching the right response from the investors. So this is where I suppose the government really has to walk a couple of steps backward for going more than a couple of steps forward. It really has to pick up a couple of enterprises, at least, which are doing well as far as a government perspective is concerned, not necessarily in the sense of earning profits and surpluses, but also in the sense of being signature flagship enterprises which bring a brand value for India, which are important entities insofar as the Indian economy, and maybe to an extent, if one can take that argument forward, the global presence of the Indian economy is concerned. So, well, if you look at, let's say, for example, the strategic sectors which have been put together, the atomic energy, space, defense, transport, telecom, power, petroleum, coal, banking, insurance, and financial services. Now, interesting part is that, well, these are being called four strategic sectors. I mean, they're put into four categories under the policies set out in the budget. They actually cover a lot of ground. I mean, atomic energy, space and defense, then power comes, petroleum comes, coal and minerals come. So it's a whole amount of energy, industrial mining, minerals, which are included into strategic sectors. Similarly, the entire financial sector or very large segments of it, financial services are subject to interpretation. They are coming under the strategic sector. Transport and telecommunications are going in. So this is where, again, there are two ways of looking at what the government can do and what the government should do. The first is, I think, fairly intelligently, a large amount of space has been covered under strategic sectors where there is this intention that has been declared that there will be a bare minimum presence of the public sector enterprises. Now, that bare minimum presence clearly means that the government is not going to privatize all its best performers, but it might be in a position to privatize some of the best performers. Now, again, best performance is relative. So, for example, when it comes to banks, I don't think one can realistically assume that the largest banking group in India, State Bank of India, will be put up for privatization. But that doesn't stop the oldest and most prominent insurance corporation, the Life Insurance Corporation, from being privatized in the sense that is exactly what has been announced in the budget. So yes, Nithya, to answer your question, I think the government will have to really, quote unquote, sweeten the entire package by declaring the fact that there are enterprises which have been dear to it, but these are enterprises which the government values as important commercial entities, good for doing business, and that is why it has the good faith of giving it over to the private sector, notwithstanding the fact that they could be strategic enterprises. I think the challenge for the government is going to come in the non-strategic sectors. Because in the non-strategic sectors, let's say, for example, if you look at the hotel industry, for example, or certain other similar service and manufacturing industries, textiles and so on and so forth, I think the challenge over here is that the CPACs are really down and out, as a result of which, bringing them up to a level in the market where they're really worthy of sale is going to be a difficult proposition. But then again, that is where I think the idea of monetizing idle assets is going to be important. I mean, let's say, for example, if one looks at the hotels owned by the government of India, and if one looks at a city like Delhi, for example, the ITDC hotels and so on and so forth, they are on prime pieces of real estate. And if those are being put up for sale, it doesn't really matter the condition in which the hotel specifically is in. But the fact that it is on a very, very prime piece of real estate is something which is going to be considerably appetizing for the investor. Now, the question is, not many investors will be able to afford that as well, but the ones who will be able to would surely be looking at catching a very effective bounty.
When we are talking about potential investors, obviously the idea will be, I mean, there will be, the government will be expecting foreign direct investment. Because these are, as you rightly pointed out, many are big ticket sales that are going to happen. How do you think foreign investors are going to perceive India? And do you think the recent stock market boom, the stock market has been climbing quite steadily in the past few months, would that also be a factor? Would that play a factor in the divestment process?
Let me start by answering the second point that you mentioned, Nithya, about the stock market responding. Yes, the stock market has been quite positive, which has taken many watchers by surprise. But I think this is one of those budgets over a period of a few years now, which has really made the market happy across the board. And the result of that is being experienced in a sharp recovery in foreign institutional investor inflows. The portfolio funds are coming back to the market, which is clearly an indication of the fact that hedge funds and portfolio investors are looking at India as an important market for capitalizing on the investments which they have made for the short term or the short to medium term future. And let's also keep in mind the fact that notwithstanding the Indian economy expected to contract by more than 7% in the current year, it has not led to any substantive revision in the credit ratings for the economy, no major downgradings in the ratings. And just before the budget, even the International Monetary Fund came out with a very robust estimate of 11.5% growth for the Indian economy. Now, all these factors are probably contributing to a certain degree of investor confidence about India. But this is where I'd like to come to the first question that you raised and distinguish between investor confidence of two varieties. The first is the one that we have already discussed, which is the hedge fund portfolio investor variety, which is not really looking at firm commitment to India over the medium term, but it is more focused on spreading investments across a variety of emerging markets and trying to recover as much returns from those as possible. And within those emerging markets in the foreseeable future, the Indian capital market appears to be one of the better ones when it comes to profit capitalization and the performance of its blue chip companies, including the small caps and the mid caps. So the hedge fund and the portfolio investors are very excited. But whether that excitement also extends to long-term foreign direct investors is a different question. Now, this is where I think there are a couple of factors to be noted. The first is, across the world, and this is not just because of COVID-19, but well before COVID-19, there was a possibility, and that possibility gradually developing into a kind of a pushback as far as long-term foreign investment is concerned, because there were a substantial number of uncertainties that were happening across the world. The most prominent of these was the US-China trade war, which was casting its own shadow upon the configuration of regional production. So a large number of businesses, primarily in the chip-making industries, semiconductor industries, automobiles, textiles, as well as the tech-intensive services, they were not very clear about the character of their long-term investments, how they should apportion those, how they should split those out. So this uncertainty was compounded by the outbreak of COVID-19. And the uncertainty to an extent continues. While today we have a situation where the US administration is a different administration, today we are aware of the fact that the world is gradually looking to stabilize and reorganize itself around a large number of, let's say, fixed variables. But still, the long-term investors' interest in economies like India, which are primarily emerging markets, still susceptible to variations that happen around themselves. This kind of an investor commitment, unfortunately, is not still all-embracing. And my sense is that there will be investor interest, but that investor interest will clearly be selective, very asset and industry focused, and very focused upon the terms and conditions offered for foreign investment. So when one looks at an organization like the Air India, for example, Air India might have a completely different set of interests from foreign investors as opposed to the BPCL, or as opposed to a particular bank, maybe the Bank of Maharashtra, some such bank which is being put up for sale. Because in all these cases, it's not just a question of the investor looking at the character of the assets and its value, but also the question of the policy environment, the policies that stimulate or govern investment in these sectors, and the conditions under which the investors are going to take over these assets. And we have seen a large number of interesting takeovers that have been happening in India in recent times. One of the most prominent of these has been the Singapore-based DBS Bank's taking over of the LVB Bank in India, which is clearly, which is of course not a state-owned bank, but nonetheless, it's a prominent bank in India's private sector space. That acquisition has happened. And acquisitions don't always lead to operational outcomes which are necessarily very efficient, because they also need to take note of the institutional changes that are going to happen when one investor makes way for another. And this is something which is expected in an economy like India, where all the institutions that we are discussing in the space of disinvestment are actually old institutions. These are institutions which have certain specific ways of functioning, behaving. And when investors take them over, they actually are going to bring in totally new systems of behavior, functioning, attitudes, work culture. And those are going to sit on top of the existing counterparts of practices and systems that these organizations have. And the coexistence may not always be very harmonious. It might take a lot of time before the systems seamlessly merge into each other and the institutions start functioning in the way their new owners want them to. But in the meantime, there is always the possibility of more extra time going into what one can define as a relatively less return intensive period, so which means more costs and deeper pockets for the investors in turn. The question is that, do we really have a very large body of foreign investors in the world with substantially deep pockets who are looking to pick up the equity stakes and assets that are on offer in India in course of what might be defined as really the most promising and aggressive public sector privatization strategy that India has put up? This is actually going to be a very interesting period to watch out for, but I will simply summarize my thoughts in this regard by sharing that I think it will not be possible for us to conclude at this juncture whether the way the disinvestment policy has been spelled out will really conclusively attract investors. But at the same time, there is sufficient ground to conclude that these interests are really going to be selective, depending upon the sectors, depending upon the terms and conditions, and the institutions on offer. And those selective interests in their own way are capable of attracting fairly prominent investor interests.
So it's going to be an interesting time ahead, but there will also be many challenges, I reckon. We've already seen the Bharat Mazdoor Sangh, a union affiliated to the RSS, opposing some of the budget measures. How do you think the government is going to overcome such opposition and fast track the processes, especially when there may be need for legislative changes as well?
That's definitely going to be one of the issues to be managed carefully and probably more at the political level than at the functional level for the government, because we are aware of the hesitation and the resistance of organized labor unions to the privatization of state-owned enterprises in India. And on this occasion, the example that you took, the BMS, has a close affiliation with the RSS and the BJP. Now, the point to be noted over here is that the government has very interestingly built in privatization and disinvestment as part of the Atmanirbhar Bharat vision. Now, that is a vision which relies on a self-reliant Indian economy. It focuses on making India, it focuses on making India self-sufficient. But I think what the government is proposing and what the stakeholders of public enterprises are envisaging are different in the fact that the government is not hesitating to include private investment and even private foreign investment as a necessary resource for achieving the vision of Atmanirbhar Bharat. But that is a view which is not being shared in entirety by several stakeholders of the public enterprises who are going to be opposed to reforms. So the issue then comes down to the basic question of whether these resisting stakeholders like the BMS can really be convinced about the virtues of private and foreign investment coming into capturing the greater shares of ownership. I think this is where, again, a lot of political back and forth, a lot of consultations will be involved. At the same time, I think one should not also lose sight of the fact that these privatization intentions are being declared on the back of certain fairly deep and substantive labor market reforms which the government has announced, including the formalization of labor laws into four specific codes, organizing social security measures for the informal sector labor, and proposing minimum wages. So I guess to an extent, by doing all this, the government has also been able to paint a picture of itself as an actor which is aware of the conditions that marginal labor has experienced in India's industrial development story. It is sensitive to their requirements. It is reaching out to them. But having said that, it is not necessarily true that the government will also listen to and respond to the demands of what one might describe as the more elite sections and more protected sections of the labor market, which are clearly parts of them, at least, belong to the central public sector enterprises, which have benefited from the large amount of state support and generosity which these enterprises have got over the years, with secured jobs and a large number of other perquisites that come with those. So I think the government will clearly take this position and reach out to the stakeholders, at least those with which it has that level of comfort, to persuade them over the fact that whatever it is doing is not a totally win-win situation, but it is certainly something which would mean win for most, if not all, in terms of the greater range of benefits they envisage. And that, I suppose, is going to be the strategy going ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Palit, for this wonderful conversation. We're very glad that you could join us this afternoon.
My pleasure, Nithya. It was a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very much. And I really enjoyed being a part of this conversation. Thank you.
You were listening to South Asia Chat. To learn more about our work, visit us at isas.nus.edu.sg.